Joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate it if you would all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know who can benefit from a particular show. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive difference in the world together. And speaking of making a positive difference in the world, joining me once again as my co-host is Rachel Cove. Rachel is a serial entrepreneur, published author, mother, and researcher, the co-CEO of Transformational Solutions, a life coaching program that specializes in addiction, trauma, and personal development. Additionally, she is co-host of the new weekly podcast, Kicking It With the Coves, that she hosts with her brother, Jesse, and her father, Martin Cove. Rachel, thanks for joining us. And how are you and your beautiful family doing?
Oh my God, Alan. Well, this is one of my favorite things to do is co-host this show with you. So I'm doing amazing and my family is doing incredible. And obviously they send their love to you as you're one of their favorite people. So.
Well, I appreciate that. And I got to tell you, our show today is going to be a fun one. The title of our guest's new book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, Masked Meditation and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. So Rachel, it doesn't sound like fun.
I feel like we don't know who's going to like talk more, him, me, or you, but this is going to be incredible.
Well, but the beauty of this show is that it is about all of you. It's, you know, it's not one of those, it's about me. It's about everybody. It's about bringing people on the show like yourself that comes up with ways to make people's lives better. So, you know, I think it's going to be incredible. And I'll tell you a little bit about our guest, and I'm sharing this with everybody. Peter Coyote is an award-winning actor, author, director, screenwriter, and narrator who has worked with some of the most distinguished filmmakers in the world. Peter narrates the PBS series, The Pacific Century, winning an Emmy Award for it, as well as 8 Ken Burns documentaries, which I saw all of that were incredible, which included the Roosevelts, for which he won a second Emmy. In 2011, he was ordained as a Zen Buddhist priest, and this was part of his life I didn't know about. And also in 2015, he received transmission from his teacher, making him an independent Zen teacher. Peter, welcome to Answers Network.
Thanks so much, Alan. When Rachel was talking, I was thinking to myself, where was she when I needed her? Going through addiction, trauma, psychotherapy, and a pretty miserable time until I hit my mid-30s. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here, Peter. It's an honor and privilege to meet you. I've watched your career forever, but to know that you're an ordained Buddhist priest, Buddhism has been a huge part of my life. I have a meditation practice that I can't live without meditation. I'm just so excited to ask you a million questions and hear your story and journey. It's a privilege to get to meet you today.
Well, thanks. Start.
All right. Well, one of the questions, because as we were putting this intro together, and my thought was, what does receive transmission mean?
Oh, okay. When you study, one of the reasons I studied Zen Buddhism was I was a little suspicious about, there were guys around like Bubba Free Murray, you know, that declared themselves enlightened beings and put a quarter in the cup and go study with them. But the thing about Buddhist practice is there's a lineage from 3,000 years, 2,500 years ago, of each disciple of the Buddha has been recognized. And I have a paper, I don't know, it won't fit on the screen, called the Kechimiyaku, which lists my entire lineage from the Buddha to me. And when you receive this, when you're trained, so I can now ordain my own priests, and I actually have ordained two, and it makes you independent. They say that your eyebrows are tangled with the Buddha's eyebrows. So it's a kind, nothing's foolproof, but it's a kind of insurance policy against too many frauds and charlatans sliding in and passing themselves off as gurus.
Had you studied other religions previously?
Well, I had been in the Peyote Church for quite a time, a Native American church with peyote, a hallucinogenic cactus. I was bar mitzvahed as a young Jewish boy. I was always spiritual, but I grew up in a pretty secular political household. A lot of civil rights work, a lot of civil liberties work, and that was just the oxygen that I breathed. And then at a certain age, transforming America and these radical ideas. And I wound up a single father of a daughter whose mother had run away. I wound up with a heroin habit for 10 years. I wound up flat broke after my dad had died and in debt that nobody knew about. He had been a very rich man all my life. And I had to do something. And one of the ways in which I reconstructed myself, I had a doctor friend who gave me enough medicine to quit heroin without getting overly junk sick. And I immediately started going to a psychotherapist and meditating in a Zen Buddhist monastery. And the two practices go together pretty well because, you know, in a culture like Japan, the culture is so kind of repressive and formal that it polishes the ego and it wipes away lots of narcissistic things that we as Americans admire. We fall for one narcissistic swindler after another. And psychotherapy has been called the compassion of the West. And it's what teaches the ego how to be more objective. A lot of people think the ego's a problem. It's not. It's not until you get an idea of it as fixed and rigid and that it becomes a warden. It's actually just the awareness that has us brush our teeth and comb our hair and cross on the green and, you know, watch out for buses. So I've been doing that practice of Zen Buddhism for 50 years. I probably did 15 years of psychotherapy, rooting out some of the junkyard dogs in my psyche. And along the way, I was an actor and then I gave it up. And then I started again at 39. Because I needed to make a living. And it was that re-emergence into acting that led me to try to combine Buddhist practice and acting, which is what produced the Lone Ranger book.
You know, as you were saying that, one of the things that seemed so interesting to me is that there are so many things that we learn about acting or creating. And as we look at Hollywood, it would seem like going in there as a Buddhist priest, there might be some conflicts here. How did you deal with some of that?
It scared the hell out of me, Alan, honest. Because not only when I was in the counterculture, I was one of the founders of a group called the Diggers. And the Diggers were pretty largely credited for having pushed the bookends of cultural possibilities as far as they could go. We fed 600 people a day for nothing. We started the first free medical clinic. We started free stores where everything in the store was fixed up and working and absolutely free. And we did it as a kind of theater to say to people, why do you want to become an employee to make the money to become a consumer? We'll give you the stuff. Now, what do you really want to do? So when I had no marketable skills and I was thinking of going to Hollywood, I thought, holy hell. Here I've been doing everything anonymously, hiding myself for 10 years, not using money, not being ambitious, not being competitive, and I'm going into Babylon to make a living. So I had a long sit down with myself, and I realized that I would not be able to control the content of much of what I did. I wouldn't have any power. And I thought as a 40-year-old guy, I would have to go to Hollywood already a star, or I wouldn't have a chance. There were younger, more beautiful kids, more talented, somebody I admired. And I thought, okay, when Paul Newman goes into an audition, how's he go in? He certainly doesn't have any attitude. He's made it. He certainly doesn't have to try to seduce people to like him. That's kind of a weak play. What he's really interested in is who are they? And so I began to go into auditions that way and just study the people. Like, are they the kind of people that will do what they say? Who are they? And just by that lucky thought, I learned not to give myself away. And I learned to keep my personal power. And you could see the meeting change. They'd look at me and they'd think, boy, this guy has something. They didn't know what it was. What it was is I was trying to figure out, who are these guys? And my agent told me that I closed more auditions than any actor he'd ever made. I did 160 films in a year that stood at me old because I've done 12 or 13 Ken Burns films now and 200 documentaries. But so I went down to Hollywood and I said to myself, okay, I can only control the way I make the movie. I can't control the movie itself. So I made a vow. I will be the first guy on the set. I will know my lines. I will not compete with anyone. I will treat everyone from the lowest PA to the star exactly the same way. And I swear to you, I don't think I ever did a film where somebody didn't come to me and say, hey, man, do you have some kind of religion or something? And I'd say, why? Why are you asking me that? He'd say, well, I don't know. You're always the first guy at work. You never get angry. You never get impatient. You never fight or make status plays. And you treat me just as nicely as the director. And I would go, yes, I do. So that's the way I did it. I mean, I couldn't control. I couldn't only do Buddhist films.
Yeah. As you were saying that, you know, the thought is that it would be so nice if Hollywood or really any industry would adopt this same thought process. Imagine the differences that we would see right now, in, not only in what would be put out there, but in how much more peace we would have. And obviously we're saying this at a time in which there's a war going on, which seems like it's almost all the time. So from your lips, let's hope that we can get this out to more people and more people can understand this is something that will benefit them in so many ways.
Well, I say to people, you know, the problem with Hollywood is the same problem with Buddhism. There are people in it. And the reason I became a Buddhist was after a lifetime of politics, I realized everything is mucked up by people. The Buddha reminds us that human beings, evolutionarily come with this package of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, it serves us evolution-wise to see you as separate from me. But that's only half the story. On the other half of the story, you, I, and Rachel have never been separate from oxygen. We've never been separate from sunshine. We've never been separate from water, from pollinating insects, from microbes in the soil, from the people who grew the cotton, spun it, sewed it into our clothing. We're like ticks on the body of a dog. It's one big thing. And if you just look at half of the equation, like you're over there and I'm over there, it leads to the false belief that I can somehow win at your expense, or I can protect myself against the immensity of the universe. But when you think about it, you don't make your heart beat. You don't make yourself breathe. We're being lived by the universe. And really 90% of our worries are over. Our lives are being supported by the entirety of the universe. So, you know, why not be nice to each other?
Yeah.
I'm actually going to quote you from your book because I feel in what you're saying, it relates to this. You wrote, "It is my hope that you will enjoy the freedom that derives from knowing that all your own masks are simply faces of the formless energy of the universe, rising and falling like the ocean waves, apparently discrete, but never ever free of the ocean."
Yeah. I use that metaphor all the time. If you imagine, did you want to say something? Do motor mouth. I'm sorry. Okay. So imagine that you're standing on a cliff and you're overlooking an ocean, which is a choppy day, not big rollers, but millions of little waves peeking up and down. Well, every one of those waves could be a human life, could be a nameable thing in the universe, could be a species, could be a civilization, could be a dolphin, could be a hummingbird, could be a person. And each one rises into form for a while, and it hangs around for a while. We call that living. And then it disappears back into the ocean. But what we forget, and what those little waves forget, is that they've never, for one instant, not been part of the ocean. And remembering that just takes a whole lot of weight of what you have to do off your shoulders. When I lived in the monastery, everybody looked dressed exactly alike. I mean, exactly shaved. But after a month, you could tell who people were just by their feet. Because we walk looking down like this as we're walking into the meditation room. You could tell by the back of their head. And what I realized was the individuality is baked in. You don't have to try to be unique or an individual. It's baked in. But when everybody tries to express their individuality, what you get is a mob. You get a crowd at a football game. You know, maybe you notice the guy with the big Mickey Mouse ears, but he's not really expressing who he really is. And to have the courage to express who you really are is where freedom resides.
I love that you say to have the courage to express who you really are, because when we're children, we are innately born and we're these blank slates, and then we're programmed not being who we are as a way to survive. And I find I've been in my own psychological work for 15 years. I have 15 years in recovery myself, and I'm a huge advocate for therapy, spiritual work, everything. And I find the more I do this work, the more I wake up to who I really am and let go of who I'm not. And it's a dying process. And, you know, you said something earlier, you were talking about the ego. And I find in our culture that there's this idea that the ego is bad. And I love that you represented it as a good thing. And I'm curious, what do you think the role is of the ego?
Yeah, well, the ego is like a guardian. It's the name that we've given to our awareness of our body-mind dualism, right? It's just a name. And we confuse the map, the territory. We use the name. And after a while, people start being told enough about who they are and implying who they are by the way other people treat them and by the ways that they want to be, that it gets solidified. And one of the things that I learned in acting improvisations and this mask work that I do is I worked out this day-long class where I run you through a whole series of exercises. They're funny. Most of them are impossible to do. And so they bring up a certain kind of good-humored frustration, and they show you where the edges of your ego are. I say, how does that feel to you? And some people will say, well, that felt really unnatural to me. And other people will say, well, that felt natural. And so we just keep stretching that. And at a certain point, I put a mask on you and I hold a mirror up in front of your face. And 45 years that someone will see the mask in the mirror and they'll get a hologram of a person inside. Different walk, different structure, different history, and they'll know everything about it. Every doorway they have to identify their own self will be a doorway in that other character, but with different information behind it. And what happens is when your ordinary self leaves, so does your self-consciousness, your self-criticism, your embarrassment and shame. And you've done this cold sober. And every student does it three times with three different masks, finds three different personalities. And I use that as a loss leader. I call it enlightenment light, and say, if you want to bring this back into your life and have access to it, you need to learn how to meditate. You need to meditate, and you need to understand the description that I learned in doing this, which is there are real practical applications. When I'm working with actors, when I'm working with voiceover people, they're always trying to be as good as they can be. So one of the exercises I do in my class is the bad singing exercise. I make people sing a song as badly as they can. And no matter how badly they do it, I say, you can do worse. You're being too careful. You can do worse. It's a way of breaking up self-consciousness and getting everybody, you know, we're all bozos on the bus.
So well, Peter, I was going to say, how did you discover that wearing these masks could liberate people?
Wearing a mask. I was in a theater called the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which was a Commedia dell'arte street theater. Commedia dell'arte was 17th century Italian street theater, like Punch and Judy for grownups. And it had mastered. You had the maid who was, you know, the smartest woman in the set. And I put on the mask of this character, Pantalone, and I saw him in the mirror, and Peter Cohan just disappeared. And all of my efforts to be a nice and reasonable and honest and honorable guy were just wiped out by this living id of this character I was playing. And I couldn't go wrong. I could say anything. I was just fearless in this mask. And I never connected it for many years to my Zen practice until I started teaching acting to the children of priests in the monastery. And then the priests wanted to study. And I don't know, one day I remembered the masks and I remembered the similarity to enlightenment experiences. And I began experimenting with classes that would teach people the absence of the self. 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And so that's what the book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, is about. And then the alternate chapters in the book about The Lone Ranger and Tonto being out of work and lost after their scriptwriter died and lost in the desert. And they stumble onto the Buddha at a campfire. And the Buddha is so good about taking care of their horses and fixing the feet that the Lone Ranger figures out he must be the servant of a very wealthy man. And he convinces Tonto that they're going to stay around until he comes back and they're going to try to get a loan from him. And of course, the Buddha sees right through this. And over the course of these interspersed chapters, he tricks them into getting in good shape, to working hard, to eating right, teaches them to meditate, and each one has an enlightenment experience. And so it was a good humored way of taking some of the theoretical talk of the book and showing people, you know, the Lone Ranger was the spirit of white entitlement. He dressed in white. He was a white guy. He had silver bullets, you know. And Tonto, his Indian sidekick, you know, in Spanish, Tonto means stupid. Boy, I mean, it's horrifying to think about. So in my little thing, Tonto's like the guy that really knows which end is up next to the Buddha. But that's how the two merged finally.
I think it's interesting because in your book, I think you call this selfless freedom, right? A true holiday from self-consciousness. I love that you said holiday, like it's a vacation from self.
Well, you know, there's a big misunderstanding in Buddhism. I'm working on a book now called Vernacular Zen. Mm. And, you know, vernacular means the language of everyday people. And one of the problems that I had over the years with Zen, which is kind of a byproduct of Japan, is in every culture it existed in, Buddhism wrapped the teachings in the gift wrapping that would be acceptable to that culture. So, you know, Buddhism came out of Hinduism. So all the talk about lives and a mind hopping from body to body, that's actually Hinduism. And Buddha only mentioned that scantily as a way to win approval so that people would pay attention to his teaching. So one of the things that happens is that people often confuse the exoticism of the Japanese Zen aesthetic and the Tibetan Buddhism and the Vipassana and the Indian schools with the knowledge itself. So in this book, Vernacular Zen, I'm trying to loosen the gift wrapping, not throw it away, but loosen it to show Americans how the gifts and teachings underneath are perfectly applicable to their lives. They're not foreign and exotic at all. They're the product and the birthright of human beings. Because you mentioned, Rachel, you know, when we're born into the world, there is no dualism. We're just a little, you know, egg yolk that's there. And everybody who speaks to us is describing the world to us before we have anything to compare to. Ooh, what a cute cheek you have. Look at mommy. Look at the kitty. Look at the birdie. By the time we're 5 years old, we can run the movie we've been taught to see, in which each thing is a discrete organism, in which each thing is unrelated to every other thing. By the time we're in our teens, we're sort of sold on that perspective, and it requires a certain amount of discipline and unpacking to get back to the action, which is what's behind all forms.
Pregnant energy of the mind. I am writing that down. That is so good.
And it's yours. Keep it.
I think you're also talking about this fixed identity, right? So like by the time we get to adolescence, do you feel that this fixed identity is formed?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, just think, you go to school and let's say you're a little black kid and you go to school with a bunch of white kids who have funny ideas from home about who you are. Their responses to you are going to shape who you think you are. And then you're going to get other responses from your parents that are going to tell you you're fabulous, or maybe you don't. And little by little, you're going to try things out, impulses that come through you, and you're going to get responses. After 12 or 15 years of doing anything, we become pretty good at it. You know, I'm sure you weren't the Rachel Cove today when you started.
Thank
I'm
God.
Sure Alan wasn't the Alan of today, right?
Thank so God.
We fake it till we make it.
Yes.
And so one of the things I learned in my addiction was that I had a junkyard dog in my psyche. And if I didn't feed him, he would just shred me. Anytime things didn't go away, I could fall into despair or self-hatred or something, because I had had a lot of training in that. And so once you kind of manage to get yourself out of the briar patch, then it requires some practice to stay there. And the only thing that bothers me about the current fascination with psychedelics, and I have nothing against psychedelics. I mean, I think I would never have studied Buddhism had it not been for psychedelics. But psychedelics is like flying to the Grand Canyon in a helicopter. You get in, you get there, it's awesome. The vistas are amazing. It stretches your perspective and it just shows you a whole new world. But you flew there in a helicopter. You can't get back without the helicopter. When you can get to the Grand Canyon by walking, by meditating, leaving your own breadcrumbs, you can get back anytime you need to. So there is no one peak experience that the force of your habits can't unwind if you don't have some practice to keep you stabilized. And just look at, I mean, my friends, I love these guys, the Grateful Dead, right? Masters of psychedelia. Jerry died of an overdose. Phil Lesh has a new liver. Bobby Weir was falling down on stage drunk. It's not the psychic attention and your behavior and contain the erratic and uncomfortable and disparate thoughts and feelings that we have. And if you can't do that, you wind up in a bar, you wind up in the wrong bed, you wind up shopping, you wind up drinking, you wind up over-consuming.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. You know, Peter, one of the things I loved the way you went when you talked about the fact that we're being trained from a very, very early age by everything from the way in which they pinch our cheek or whatever. We have a lot of teachers and a lot of parents. That's the majority of our listenership. If I could give you the magic wand, what would you change in the way, especially with schooling, that we would approach children to put them in a better position to succeed in life?
Well, I know that in my life, I was parents had. I was never nursed because the best science of the day was, no, if you want a disciplined kid, you feed them on a schedule, you feed them formula, which is better than breast milk. You don't get to hold them. You don't get to smell the skin and get all of that stuff. And for many, many years, when I got hungry or my blood sugar got low, I would like fall apart. So these ideas, you know, I don't know how a mother could sit and listen to a baby crying from hunger and say, oh no, it's 45 minutes till he or she eats. So I think one of the best things that we can do for our children is just to trust that they are who they are when they emerge, and that the best thing we can do for them is to keep them out of trouble, out of danger, and try to see without judgment who they are so we can nurture that. I mean, I can say this as a guy who managed, I don't consider myself a particularly skillful father, but I have two great kids, and I did break the cycle of violence from my own family. I never laid a hand on my kids. I never bullied them or screamed at them. And I always took great curiosity in who they were. I didn't want mini-me's. I wanted my children to be authentic. And the reason that I was forced into my first divorce was I was very, very unhappy. And I was just sticking around for the kids and the this and that. And I thought, how am I going to teach my children to be authentic if I'm lying every day? And, you know, divorce was a trauma on my son. I thought for a long time I was not going to have a relationship with him. It worked out. I mean, I stayed consistent. I was and I just stayed in his life and just did my best. And eventually he realized that I, you know, I wasn't stupid and I didn't hate him. But I think the biggest thing is parents have all these fixed ideas about who their kids have to be so that the love they receive is conditional. Rachel, I'm guessing that you read the book, The Drama of the Gifted Child.
Well, you know what? So this book, I have it. It's literally sitting right in there. I just have yet to read it, but I know all about it.
Okay, you know all about it. You may not know she was a terrible abuser of her child.
Well, it's interesting because the woman who created, I think she created DBT was because originally she was diagnosed with borderline personality herself. So she wanted to create a solution for a problem she suffered with.
Yeah. So my daughter's a psychologist, PhD psychologist. Amazing. And it's kind of her belief that CBT and DBT are about the only therapies that work. They're sort of short term. They're symptom oriented. And anyway, I'm not discrediting her because I read that book four times. But if you remember, what she said is that particularly sensitive children, mm-hmm. when they evince a behavior that disturbs the parent, they feel the parent's disturbance as a withdrawal of love. Mm-hmm. And for a child, an infant, that means death.
Right.
That means if you're abandoned, if you're left alone, you can't take care of yourself. So what the child does is it immediately cuts that impulse out of its personality. And now it's created a double bind because it's learned how to behave and win its parents' love, but it's also learned that itself is wanting Fisher that is the reason that people pretend to be other than who they are.
Yes, something I'm a huge advocate for teaching in the groups I run and with my clients is introducing people to the concept of survival traits and that you've learned these traits in order to survive, that you're not born bad, you're not born wrong, you learned how to adapt in this world with whatever cards you were dealt with, and you learned that if you did this, mom or dad would withdraw from their love from you, like you said, so really, your body is actually doing what it needs to do to keep you alive. Let's thank that part of you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I totally get it. Yeah. You know, Alan asked me about teaching, about school. So there is something I'd like to say about that.
Sure.
So in the first place, no Asian company, no Asian country or no European country runs their schools on local tax bases. Wow. Because they've figured out poor tax bases are going to have poor schools and rich tax bases are going to have good schools, and they don't want any of their students to lose. So in Asia, if a school is failing, they marry it to a successful school. They will not let it fail. So one of the things we have to look at is the ambivalence that Americans have about respecting education. First of all, we pay our teachers like crap. And so consequently, we're not actually attracting the best and the brightest. We may be, but they're very selfless people because my girlfriend was a teacher. I've had lots of friends who were teachers who were buying their own crayons and pencils and papers for the kids. So until we really decide that education is in the national interest and that education, not what they're trained kids in critical problem solving, in thinking, in discipline, in hard work, because our competitors all over the world are training their children that way. America is now 13th in math and sciences, the richest country on earth, and we're 13th in math and science. We have a higher infant mortality rate than Cuba and Poland. So we have to decide, first of all, that children are more precious than making money, which means that we have to pay the taxes and rearrange the funding of schools so that every school is considered a priceless resource. And then we need to attract the best educators, and we need to let them teach. I don't want a mouth breather saying that my son can't read Huck Finn because it's got bad words in it, or there's a book of gay world when they've been cushioned and coddled and untrained in dealing with any unpleasant feelings or complexities. So that, you know, education begins at home, and our parents should be teaching kids to be flexible and fluid and problem solving. But, you know, they're passing on their own traumas. They're passing on their own prejudices. And, you know, what I see now is that education itself is under fire, with people burning books and bullying the school boards. And we're going to produce a nation of morons. And the rich people can send their kids to boarding school, and those kids will be CEOs of companies employing mouth breathers as employees. And what are they going to make that people are going to want to buy? This is because more and more businesses in the United States do not allow the clients any feedback. Think about school. Think about prison. Think about unemployment. Think about mental health. Think about the army, where it doesn't matter what kind of service is given to them. The people receiving the service can't criticize. So the employees themselves become bored, become don't care, and everything is downgraded. And there's a book by a guy named Edgar K. Friedenberg called The Disposal of Liberty and Other Industrial Wastes. And he spelled this problem out in the early 70s. He was an award-winning educator, and it's only gotten worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually reminds me of a book. And it's a book that I changed the name of the book, but it was in about 1986. It was by Alan Bloom. And it was, and I called it The Dumbing Down of the American Society.
That's not the name, but I know the book.
Yes, I know. Yeah. It's not the name, but it's exactly what you think when you read it.
Yes, I'm going to look it up while we talk, because I read it.
All right. Well, while you're doing that, we're going to take a break real quick.
Okay.
So for everybody out there, you know, my co-host is Rachel Cove. Our guest is Peter Coyote. The book is The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we and I are thinking about Well, we're talking about a lot of things, but one of the things is his new book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. So, Peter, you were looking something up there as we went to break.
I was looking up the name of Alan Bloom's book, but your loudspeaker took over my computer and I couldn't turn it off. So every time I would say Alan Bloom, the sentence would be finished by the announcer speaking. So maybe if I type while we talk, but
that's okay. But no, I was just bringing it up because it reminds me of exactly what you're talking about. And I know that Richard Dreyfuss is doing a lot of work right now trying to bring back civics back into our teaching, because civics it's been removed, you know, slowly removed. They started in about the 80s and they started removing civics. And so we want people out there what civics is or what's expected of you as a citizen.
It started earlier, Alan. Okay. If you ask people to Google Lewis Powell memo, Lewis Powell, 2 months before he was appointed a Supreme Court justice by Nixon, Lewis Powell wrote a letter to the National Chamber of Commerce, and he was one of the architects of unwinding the New Deal and creating a pro-business climate in the United States. They were very disturbed by the anti-business climate of the left and the countercultural revolutions. And he produced this document, which has been followed lockstep for 50 years. And in 1973, Reagan became president and he declared government the enemy. He fired 11,000 traffic, weakened the National Labor Relations Board, opened up right-to-work states, made union organizing more difficult, and basically weakened the prosperity-creating organism of the middle class, the unions. And for 50 years, backed by conservative millionaires like the Koch brothers, Richard Scaife Mellon, the Coors family, these guys have been setting up think tanks and taking over school boards. And it's a credit to their discipline. They were disciplined and they were persistent. But the problem is when you make government the enemy and then you vote people in office who believe that way, and they get in power, they put agency heads in that weaken the agencies, fire the people, the services get bad, and government becomes less and less capable of performing its function. That's been going on for a byproduct of it.
That's very sad.
You can read that memo online. Lewis Powell memo.
No, I just made a note of it as well, so I'm very interested. But what I was going to say, let's come back to the book. One of the things I didn't realize is time has absolutely flown by. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about the book. You told us a little bit about masks. I think we all understand meditation. Let's talk a little bit about how we can improvise play and induce liberated states. I know you talk about it in the book, so I want the people that are listening or watching to get a feel for that.
Well, let's start first of all with meditation.
Okay.
Because most people don't know how to meditate. And most people imagine that they're chasing some ideal state. Well, if you sit down with an idea of yourself over here and enlightenment over there, they're never going to come together. So one of the purposes that meditation does is by concentrating on a posture and putting your attention on your exhales, you're denying impulses to the brain. The body's not moving. It's not texting. You're not listening to music. I don't like meditation where people talk to me. And gradually, the activities of the mind quiet on their own. Mm-hmm. You can't quiet them. And as they do, you begin to see the transient nature of thoughts itself, that thoughts are like soap bubbles. And whether you like it or you don't like it, it's going to rise, it's going to hang around for a little while, and it's going to disappear. And the central truth of the human universe. So once you begin to get comfortable with that, and once you get comfortable with the idea that there is no self in there that you can find, you can't find a location for it. You can't find a shape for it. You can't find a color for it. So if I said, Rachel, I got a car for you. You're going to love this. I can't remember the brand. I can't remember the model, and I can't remember the color or where I parked it. You would be a little suspicious. But we all take this idea of a self just as a given. It's in there somewhere. Well, once you understand that it's just an awareness, play begins to take care of itself. So I have all these exercises in the book, many of which you can do at home. And if you're paying attention, every time you change your posture, it will change your inner life. So for instance, I make people do an exercise with a little red dot like a laser. And I start them by putting it on their nose. And I make them begin in a very exaggerated way, walking around like this and cataloging their feelings. And then little by little, I have them pull it back till maybe it's just like this. And then I have them go out in the street and see how it changes the way they feel. Or I'll put it on their chest and make them be erect and walk around the room and see how it makes them feel. And then pull it back to where they're comfortable. And so as you start, each time you change your posture, you're enlarging your sense of self. You're bringing new, sometimes you feel like an animal, sometimes you feel like a butterfly, sometimes you feel very confident. And all of those things are like dials that any actor learns how to play with, but most civilians don't know. And when you harness these things to realizing that there's no armature inside us, you know, an armature is the inside of a clay sculptor where they pack the clay around the armature to hold it up. We don't have an armature. We have a spine. That's our armature. But the self is not an armature. And once you realize that there's nobody home, the fun begins. And then, of course, you have to be careful, because you have to be careful you don't hurt people. You have to be careful you're not kind. But you, what nirvana means, and that's a word people play with a lot, what nirvana means is that you are absolutely free in the next moment to do whatever you want.
Why do you feel people avoid meditation?
Well, why do people avoid self-knowledge? You know, why are the bars full? Why are people picking up dating all over the internet? Why are people going to bars to meet dates? You know, you're going to meet a girl that hangs out in a bar. Yeah. I mean, want to raise your children? So meditation, I think it forces people to confront what their life actually is. And when they first begin, their mind is so busy, it makes them kind of wacky because they don't know how to detach from it. They don't know that the putting your attention on your posture, and this, I'll show you the mudra that we use, where you put, I'm left-handed, so mm-hmm. I put my left hand under my right hand. And you make this little, this is my attention gauge. If this collapses, my attention is collapsed. If it separates, my attention is collapsed. So by paying attention to my posture, my breathing, and that mudra, I've sequestered enough awareness that my mind can't run away with my thoughts. It's not like if she ever says that to me again, I'm going to run her over with my car, and all of a sudden I'm in a fantasy. No, I'm holding myself in place, and I'm just letting it do what it does. You can detach from your mind, and it doesn't matter what you think. You're not going to be blown by a leaf. You're going to learn that you can contain it all, and what you contain is pure energy. If I throw gasoline on the ground, it just burns off or causes a fire. If I put it in the rigid form of a motor, it does work. Mm-hmm. If I subject the energy of my brain and the impulses of affliction and what arises in my mind to this strict form, which looks like the absence of freedom, I'm actually containing that energy, and I can go out and do good work with it. So we say formal practice, informal mind. My mind is completely free. It has no chains holding it down. And once you experience that, it's such a rest and such a relief, and it saves you so much energy and stress. And experience that is by subjecting yourself to the formal discipline of sitting still and not moving. It seems like a contradiction, but that's what it is.
Peter, thank you so much. And the engineer is telling me that we're out of time, and because time has absolutely flown by, there was a couple of questions that came in, didn't get a chance to ask them. What is the best way that people could get in touch with you? And one of the things maybe we can do is I'll post these questions on our site or send them to you, and we can still, you can still give them answers.
So you can, send them to me.
Okay.
At, if it's about this kind of stuff, you can send them to me at SF, like San Francisco, Zen Dog, sfzendog at gmail.com. If you want to get in touch with me at WDPROD, like Wild Dog Productions, Peter at WDProd.com. But I don't read the SF Zen Dog stuff every day because I get my mind ready to answer questions there.
Right. Well, so Peter, thank you so much.
Well, thank you both.
And it's not been just for so coming on, fun. Rachel. Thank you again, once again. And Peter, you mentioned that you have another book coming out. So how soon is it coming out? Because we'd love to have you back, or we'd love to have you back even if the book isn't ready.
So I have three books that are published right now. One is called Sleeping Where I Fall, about the 60s. Mm-hmm. The sequel is called The Rain Man's Third Cure, How You Get from a Heroin Addict to Being a Zen Priest. My first book of poems came out in December of this year, just after The Lone Ranger and Tonto. I don't know about the vernacular Zen. I'm about three quarters worth of the way editing it, and I never sell them first. I don't want a deadline. I don't want to release it till, mm-hmm. you know, I'm ready with it. But if my website is petercoyote.com, www.petercoyote.com, and I'll be putting it out there.
That's Peter, great. I'm going to be emailing you as well. So just watch out for my email.
I got you. I got you both. Thank you for a lovely hour.
Thank you, both Peter. Of you,
thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from my chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.